Up and down the food chain, the big eat the little. So many little food companies have been eaten, only 11 big food companies are now left to provide us with most of what we eat. And so we ask, does the consolidation of food make us more or less secure?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,155th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Santiago who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio on the Food Chain. So as a host of the Food Chain Radio program, I come to observe that certain trends along the food chain seem to hold true. And so about 1,000 editions ago, I offered them up as Michael Olson's three laws of the food chain. The second law is the farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in our food. Follow along for just a minute, see if I can explain. If, for example, we grow a melon in our garden, we will have a lot of control over what goes into that melon. But if we buy a melon from a farmer in China, we will have very little control over what goes into that melon. This principle holds true for the companies from which we buy food. If we buy a melon from a local farmer at the farmer's market, we can look into their eye and see what's in the melon. But if we buy a melon from the big box store, we have to rely on the big box store to tell us what's in the melon. A few generations ago, we all lived very close to the land and to the food, and so we're very much in control over what went in our food. Then most of all of us moved into town, where we became reliant on others to provide our food. Those companies that did provide our food prospered and grew and consolidated. Today, 11 companies provide us with most of the food we eat. And so today we pause to ask, does this consolidation of food make us more or less secure? Who better to ask than Claire Calloway, who is a food reporter and a policy analyst for Open Markets Institute. Claire, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you for having me.
So, how did you become a foodie?
Yeah, well, I grew up, I think what you said about being distanced from our food really resonates with me. Because I would say for most of my life, I was fairly distant from my food. I grew up in the suburbs in a very, I'd say, conventional food household, even though my dad came from an agricultural background. But for most of my life, I was really not aware of where my food was coming from. I was always very interested in the environment. And so, you know, when I realized how much agriculture and our food choices impact the environment and sort of became to become aware of, you know, variety of social and economic issues that we see in our modern food system, mm-hmm. I was both very interested in, you know, how complex this issue was, but I think most interested in the fact that food is something everyone eats every day, and at least me, myself, I was very unaware of how it was made and where it came from. And that disconnect in and of itself is perhaps what I find the most interesting about issues of in the food system and how I've, you know, continued in this work and continue to be dedicated to writing about it. And now am a food journalist.
A food journalist. I guess that's what I am too. If I were to blame myself for anything, it would be probably be that. The fun thing about food, of course, is that you can use food to talk about just about anything and make it fun. Got to wondering, as you were describing, you know, being in the suburbs and being far away from your food, do you think that sooner or later that distance from our source of our food kind of catches up to us and gets us to wondering, wow, I'm really vulnerable here?
Yeah, I would say so. And certainly in my work, focusing on issues of economic and corporate concentration in the food system, we see that this not only, you know, makes it more complicated to have greater transparency into our food supply, but as we have, you know, more and more people in between, whether that's processing, distributing, selling our foods. And as those, you know, companies become more and more concentrated, it has really big economic consequences for farmers and food producers, as they have, you know, fewer and fewer people who can purchase their products. And so, I think that distance has, again, a lot of implications for transparency, but also economic outcomes.
You know, that consolidation, as you just brought up, has an incredible way of putting a wedge between people and their farmers, right?
Yeah, definitely.
And so both, I guess, both farmers and consumers become vulnerable or dependent upon those in the middle, those consolidated companies in the middle. You're with the Open Markets Institute. What is that?
Yeah, we are a think tank, again, based in D.C. Our mission is to sort of empower people and Americans to, reclaim their fundamental freedom to be independent citizens, I guess, which, I mean, basically we focus on, it's a lot of flowery language to say we focus on monopolies and how increased corporate concentration has led to, you know, a slew of different outcomes, and just try to, you know, lessen that power that they have.
We always like to ask, you know, who funds you? And given from what you just told us, I'm not thinking you're getting much money from the Monsanto Corporation.
No. We don't accept any corporate funds. And that's actually, about a year ago, we used to be a part of New America, and which is another group of think tanks. And we split over some disagreements and with some of where they got their funding and how that was affecting our work. And so, yes, that is definitely a big part of our organization's core.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a look, a thumbnail, if you will, at our industrial food system, because we note here very recently that Monsanto, one of our nation's biggest seed and chemical companies, was just purchased by Bayer AG. And so what was very big is now monstrous. Is that happening throughout our food chain?
Yes, absolutely. Especially in, again, in the case of Monsanto, it's, you know, a critical farm input. And so we see there classic examples of this Monsanto going through, you know, dozens of mergers, buying up smaller competitors over the past few decades, but also with their combination with Bayer, and I guess something Monsanto was involved in before, but examples of vertical integration. Mm-hmm. So businesses beginning to, in this example, provide, you know, both the seeds and then also the seed treatments and pesticides that, you know, are made to go with those seeds. These trends of vertical integration and acquisitions we see in, you know, meat processing, other pesticide companies, and also retail. So what happens when we have fewer and fewer grocery stores?
You know, I got to thinking how this, we talked about a little bit about how this consolidation separates people from their farmers. And I can remember milking cows and walking back to the house with two buckets full of milk. I would bet today that you could find a whole bunch of professional dairy persons who milk lots of cows but have to buy their milk from the store. And in that, it's kind of the same way that farmers are. They used to plant their own seeds, and now they buy their seeds and everything else from somebody else. And so they're dependent now on others who live in the middle of the food chain between the consumers and the producers. And so we're all pretty much dependent then on those who are in the middle, right?
Yes. No, and that's one of the main things we look at is how there's been both this increased dependency, but then how this, you know, power manifests itself through that dependency, and what it means when there are, you know, fewer people who are controlling these functions that we're also increasingly dependent on. Just create the real recipe for
dependency.
Dependence and in some cases,
vulnerability.
You know, yeah, abuses of power.
Okay, folks, we're going to take a quick break. Michael Olson here. This is the Food Chain radio program, What's Eating What? Today, we're talking with Clara Kellaway, who is a food reporter and policy analyst for the Open Market Society. And you, are we more vulnerable now? Or what do you think? Right back.
We're on the farm with Joel Salatin.
Would you like to buy homemade soup, backyard chicken, and the neighbor's artisanal lunch meat? The Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund protects your right to acquire the food of your choice from the source of your choice. I'm Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm, and I urge you to defend the right of neighbors to engage in direct food commerce. Join today at farmtoconsumer.org, the food of your choice from the source of your choice. That's farmtoconsumer.org, farmtoconsumer.org. Thank you.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro Farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it, Metro Farm it. You can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it, Metro Farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it, Metro Farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it, Metro Farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it, Metro Farm it. Dream it, build it, own it, it's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
What on earth happened to our food chain? Some few decades ago, most all of us lived close to the land, grew our own food, ate our own food, maybe traded with the neighbors. And then we all moved into town, and we relied on others to prepare, to grow and process and prepare and our food, and maybe even deliver it to us, or we could drive up to it and get it. Food is much easier now, but is that easiness better for us? Have we become more vulnerable to the food producers? Does that make us stronger? That is the subject today on the Food Chain Radio program with Michael Olson and Claire Kellaway, food reporter and policy analyst for the Open Markets Institute. Why, Claire, has there been so much consolidation on the food chain? What happened to it?
Yeah, I would say I think it's helpful to disaggregate this question and think about consolidation that we've seen amongst food producers, so the number of farmers that we have and that are able to make a living farming, and then also consolidation, like you said, amongst all the other companies around the whole food chain. I would say there's two sort of distinct changes in our set of agriculture and also antitrust policies that have led to some of the consolidation we see on the producer end. I think it's a common narrative that we hear a lot, the change in starting in the 50s to a more market-oriented, pro business, you know, the classic Earl Butt, get big or get out form of.
But we all bought into that, Claire, did we not? Didn't we all buy into that when we moved off the farm? Didn't we just love the notion of getting a TV dinner at the time? Wasn't that the greatest thing in the world?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think, I think it's, it goes both ways. I feel like there was definitely intentional in terms of thinking about people demanding more convenient food and more processed food. I think a lot of that was also started by, you know, marketing, you know, saying food is, you know, hard to procure and hard to cook. Up until that, we think about, you know, when things like the processed cake was first introduced, they actually added the step of adding an egg because people at first were not, they're kind of scared of the idea of this is just made out of a box. They wanted to have a little more work in making the cake.
Wanted to feel alive, right?
Right. They wanted to feel like they're actually doing something. I mean, it is hard to say where, you know, this desire for convenience came from, but in terms of, you know, this increase in mergers and acquisitions that we've seen since the 80s, other companies buying each other, that a lot of that is a result of a change in how we think about antitrust.
Oh.
A lot of our antitrust laws were started with this idea of looking at this thing called market structure. Basically, how the market looks, one indicator is, you know, how many firms, how many businesses control a certain share of the market. That's not the only indicator. But that was where a lot of our antitrust laws started. And then in the 80s, there was a switch to focus pretty narrowly on this idea of consumer welfare, which is often defined by price. So basically, is this merger going to increase prices? When you have that narrow focus, it's allowed a lot of mergers that maybe in the past wouldn't have gone through.
Did not agriculture and food in general fall in love with the economic principle of economies of scale, wherein everybody encouraged every producer to get bigger, get out?
Mm-hmm.
You know, instead of having 100 acres, have 1,000 acres. That way you can spread your costs over many more acres and the costs become less. Did that not have a lot to do with it as well? And then,
yes.
And then with respect to that, to those economies of costs and antitrust policies, I'm just wondering, you know, if you have 1,000 acres, isn't it a lot easier to donate to a politician than if you have 1 acre?
Absolutely. So that's another big, so monopolies in our view are both an issue because of some of the, you know, issues of control we've discussed, the control they have over the producers and the consumers and the supply chain. But also, you know, as these entities get larger, they have increased political power. And we've seen that this has also allowed greater corporate influence into just agricultural policy itself, but also the suppression of policies that would, you know, maybe give more protection to small producers. I think about the failure of the 2010 grain inspection, pastures and stockyard rule changes. It's like a really recent example of, you know, big producer influence, big company influence, preventing changes in laws that would give farmers more protection.
So in other words, when you increase your economies of scale, you get two benefits with the government. One, you can afford to influence policy to help you do mm-hmm. things. Maybe you can get a special tax break or access to public water or who knows what. And the other thing is that you can pass laws to make it harder for other people to compete with you.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Do you think those have a lot to do with the great consolidation that we've seen as well?
Yes. I mean, once industries can consolidate power, it does make it difficult in the absence of, you know, new either legislation or legal system, like new judiciaries, new judges, to or just new legal precedent, yeah, to sort of undo that power that's been accrued.
So as we look from, you know, the power of those who have become very big and consolidated to control their world, there's a flip side of that too then, which makes it much harder for those who do not have those economies of scale to survive and prosper as well, right?
Yes. We see that not only does consolidation create a lot of barriers to entry, especially today in which, you know, to go back to the idea of the Monsanto-Bayer merger, precision farming is becoming increasingly important and data is becoming an increasingly more valuable, I guess, commodity, you can say.
Sure, it is, right? Information.
Yes, information. And that's now a huge advantage that some of these companies have over smaller ones. Just, you know, the amount of information they have access to that competitors can't really catch up to get that same amount of information. But I think that's just one example of a barrier to entry. But there's, you know, there's many when, you know, you have.
Sure. Health and safety codes are one. You know, you have to have a certain kind of production facility to process meat, for example. And the only ones who can really afford to comply with those rules are those who have very big production facilities that can spread the costs of inspectors and whatnot over a much greater number of products produced. So it always seems to me to what a deep throat say, follow the money, always seems to come down to that for one reason or another. When we come back, I'd like to talk about what impact all of this consolidation has had on our food chain. What does it look like out there? You wrote an interesting piece about 4th of July and how so much of our 4th of July is owned by 11 companies. Oh, my goodness. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, having a lot of fun talking about the consolidation of our food chain. Does it make a difference to you? Might. Do stay tuned.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, it sure looked like a fun way to celebrate the 4th of July, take a family picnic, go out to the country, by the river, by the lake, by the ocean, cook up a bunch of stuff and eat it and have fun. But you know what? According to our guest today, Claire Calloway, much of what we eat for the 4th of July celebrations and all the rest of our celebrations is owned by 11 companies. Just think of it, folks. Not too many generations ago, we all lived very close to our food and grew our food and processed it and shared it with our neighbors and friends. Now it comes from 11 companies. Wow. Claire, what does that look like?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting, I think you could call it a paradox in that in some ways, I think as a lot of people can relate, our grocery stores are actually much larger today than they were a few decades ago. We have way more options to choose from, sometimes to the chagrin of perplexed buyers, you know, the paradox of choice.
That's me right there, perplexed buyer.
Yes.
I walk into the supermarket of life, I'm tired, I'm grumpy, and I'm thirsty. And what do I see in front of me? 1,000 things to drink.
Yes, we have in some ways more choices than ever before. But I think to the point of my article, that's actually where your money is going to fewer and fewer people despite having more and more options. And we see that when you really, you know, dig behind the surface of all these brands, that brands in some ways are used to obscure the fact that very few companies are producing the vast majority of of our foods. And when you look into, you know, specific categories, you see really shocking amounts of concentration, like two companies selling more than 80% of our mayonnaise, one company selling 70% of our tortilla chips.
Let's talk about beer.
Yeah.
Beer. What fun, right? And we're all aware, of course, that the consolidation of beer into one or two hands, Anheuser-Busch, InBev, and Miller Coors, has been almost matched by the blossoming of small beer. But many of those small beers are being sucked up into that giant consortium, right?
Yeah, beer is an interesting example where if you look, you know, purely at market share, some people might make the case that, you know, AB InBev and Miller Coors have actually lost a bit of their market share in the past, you know, 5 years. Even though, you know, AB InBev bought SAB Miller, which was this really big merger that happened just a few years ago, led to a spinoff of Miller to Coors and all this. But, you know, still, it does look like that these players, you know, which have been large giants, may actually be facing some true competition from craft brewers. But I think to look purely at that understates the influence that these companies have over the beer supply chain. You know, not only, as you said, are these companies buying up a lot of craft brands, they also have, you know, venture capital arms where they will, you know, invest in new brands with, you know, the potential to buy them later. They own, I think, I can't remember the exact name, but like popular beer rating websites, actually owned by these companies. And then, you know,
Wait a minute. Did you say the beer ratings websites are owned by the companies as well?
Yes. I'm blanking on the exact name, but there's this one really popular beer rating website that I believe is owned, and I am also blanking on which company it's owned by, but yes, it's in some ways, you know, what seems to be a very independent force for people to, you know, talk about and rate different beers is actually, overseen by...
You know, that's a very good way of illustrating my contention then that economies of scales really helps, because here you have a website that's designed to capture impressions or information, which is valuable, as you said. Now, if you're a craft brew maker, a neighborhood craft brew maker, the chance of you being able to afford, you know, that kind of public relations trick are very slim. But if you're, you know, Anheuser InBev or Miller Coors, you know, you can spread that cost over a billion cans of beer. Not a big deal.
Absolutely. I think to clarify, it looks like, you know, AB InBev owns a major stake in ratebeer.com. So, yeah, it's that is something that only, you know, a large company with a lot of money to move around can invest in something like that. And again, in that vertical integration across the industry. Similarly, even though, what's interesting about beer is we have laws in place, you know, post-prohibition laws that actually try to build in some, distance between brewers and bars. So legally, Budweiser couldn't own a bar. But we still see that these large companies can have power over, you know, distribution, which is really critical to the beer industry, to say if you want to carry our product, you know, you can't carry these other ones.
And there are local distributors who have that franchise. You want to get to the store, you got to get there through us, right? Now, in looking at the categories you have laid out in your 4th of July piece, incidentally, the title of that piece was... these 11 companies control everything about the 4th of July, and it was in Vice magazine, correct?
Yes.
Okay, good. So that being important. Now, you had like four or five categories laid out: hot dogs and sausages, beer, chips, condiments, and charcoal and accessories. But I got to looking at these and I got to thinking, which sector would I like to own most? Hot dogs and sausages, beer, chips, and condiments. Which one do you think is the most lucrative, Claire?
That's an interesting question. I think obviously these are all fairly, I don't know how like the total revenue of each of these industries compares. I think the meat is one I always look to as, you know, certainly it's thin margins, but it's a very large industry. You know, it's one of those fundamental industries. But I guess I don't know off the top of my head which
has the best margin. Would it be, I'm looking at chips. I mean, chips have to have a great margin, don't you think? And then ketchup. I mean, the ketchup is like, it has to have a huge margin there too. So I'm torn between whether I want to be Pepsi Cola or Kraft Heinz.
Right. I know a lot of these, a major benefit of these companies is when...
Wait a minute. We just ran out of time for this segment, but we will pick it up when we come back. Having too much fun, Michael Olson, Food Chain Radio, and you.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, I don't know. Which one would you rather own? PepsiCo, which controls 66% of potato chips, 71% of tortilla chips. Anheuser-Busch and MillerCoors, which control, I don't know, how much percentage of the beer do they control, Claire?
About two-thirds.
Two-thirds. That should be immoral for two companies to control 60. That's just immoral. But it is what it is, and I'll have to go down the street and have a beer at my local brewery and commiserate over that. Condiments. Kraft and Heinz and ConAgra control 80% of the condiments. So if we go on that 4th of July picnic that Claire wrote about in Vice magazine, well, we're going to be eating stuff from them. And is that good or is that bad? What do we get from this great consolidation of our food chain, Claire? What benefits do we get as consumers?
I mean, certainly, again, because of how our antitrust laws and how these, you know, mergers have been evaluated, a lot of it is a focus on price. And so in some ways, you know, a lot of people will argue that, well, this has been able to lower the cost of food considerably. However, I guess I don't know. I would take issue with the argument that we need to create monopolies in order to have affordable food, especially considering the fact that, in the past couple of years, we've actually seen a few lawsuits around price fixing that can happen. You know, in our tuna cans was one that was recently convicted. Also, our chicken and our pork.
Claire, notion that we get cheap food from big agriculture caused me some years ago to come up with Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, which is cheap food isn't. I believe they make food cheap by taking nutrition out of it and by forcing others to subsidize its true cost of production. So I think the cheap food they're selling us is really the expensive food they're delivering us. But that's just me, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I could get into a lot of trouble thinking like that.
Yes. I mean, I would personally tend to agree. Environmental economics is one of my favorite
there you go.
Subjects. And, you know, that's the very idea that the price does not reflect the true, what's called the social cost. So when you're buying, for instance, cheap meat, you're maybe not paying for the cost that the pollution that might have been created from that meat, or the cost of someone's health care who maybe now has an injury from working long hours in a meat processing plant. There are certainly a lot of hidden costs that are introduced when we cut corners through, again, these economies of scale and, yeah, just overall cost reduction.
Do you know, it seems to me the greatest benefit that we get from the great consolidation of our food chain is convenience. Because food is always on the corner. It might not be, you know, the kind of food that we got when we grew it our own, but mm-hmm. it's convenient. Mm-hmm. And it certainly is not cheap. It's actually, you know, for the nutrition you get in a Snickers bar, you could buy probably a steak or something reasonable, mm-hmm. you know, but it is convenient. And that, to me, is the principal benefit of the consolidation of the food chain. I think about my father, who was in World War II in the Pacific on a destroyer. And all they talked about was ice cream, because they did not have a machine to make ice cream on this destroyer. And so ice cream was the greatest thing in their lives. And so here today, you can find ice cream on any street corner, almost. Mm-hmm. And so who cares about ice cream to that extent that my father and his fellow shipmates did? You know, and that convenience has really changed our lives. And to me, that's the chief benefit. But what did we lose when we gave up our ability to take care of ourselves?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think there's that is a really great question. And especially when you think about people with less resources and less time, you know, as we see more and more people working longer hours and just really struggling to make it by, that convenience can be really appealing. And yet at the same time, we see that convenience can be exploited, and a lot of people, you know, without access to even, you know, a kitchen or a time to cook, and what that means for people's health, and to your last point, also what it means in terms of people's access to grow their own food and access to even a grocery store. In some places, it really has a big concern in terms of this idea of food sovereignty and our true ability to choose, you know, what kind of food we're eating, where it's coming from.
And, you know, that kind of takes us to a point my studio guest brought up earlier, which was, what about Venezuela? And if you think about now having to rely on 11 companies for the majority of our food, what happens if those 11 companies are, for one reason or another, withdrawn from the marketplace? Then what happens? Mm-hmm. That seems to be what happened in Venezuela. So, food security and sovereignty, when we come back from this, our last break, with Claire and you and me.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Folks, some years ago, I had the opportunity to work for David Brinkley at NBC Magazine. We were working on a piece on survivalists up in the southern Oregon, the Rogue Valley of southern Oregon. And they called them survivalists then. I think they're called preppers now. But they're people who essentially believe that the whole world's going to fall apart. And so they're ready. They are ready. They have their cans of crackers and their guns and their little survival ranchette, and they're ready for Armageddon. And of course, it's not going to happen here. But you know, it did happen in Venezuela, a country with more hydrocarbons resources. It's a nation that sits on the biggest lake of oil in the world, and somehow that nation went bankrupt, and somehow the availability, people lost their availability to grow their own, to eat, to get food. And so I wonder, of course, it can't happen here, but it did happen there. And does that consolidation of our food chain make us ever more vulnerable to something, maybe just about anything happening to those 11 companies? Then what, Claire?
Yes, absolutely. I think when, again, there's more power, more reliance, and fewer really critical functions, it does create a lot of vulnerability in something as fundamental to life as food. I think we've talked about seeds earlier, and seeds are a really good example. Something as fundamental as biodiversity and genetics is really eroding away when we have fewer companies providing us both our seeds and also our animals and our livestock. When we have less genetic diversity and reliance on fewer players in the face of things like climate change, when we're going to need an incredibly reliant food system and some, you know, perhaps very well-adapted regional food systems, certainly that creates big questions about will we be able to face these challenges, and is a more decentralized, diverse food system more resilient? I would argue that it is.
Well, and, you know, last week we did a program on people, bad actors, hacking into our national food chain looking for vulnerabilities. Mm-hmm. You know, going around the digital corridors of production. And our guest pointed out just how vulnerable are those industrial food chains are to, you know, somebody going in and turning the wrong switch and things turning off. And so I always wonder about that and hope that somehow we're able to build a local and regional food chain which we can support, which can provide food for us, in addition to Anheuser-Busch InBev. And so I'm there at the local brewery and the local farmer's market, and I hope all the rest of you are too. Claire Kellaway, food reporter and policy analyst for the Open Markets Institute. Thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. And so, do you eat to live or live to eat, Claire?
I absolutely live to eat.
All right. Thank you very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Have a great day.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. And thank you all for tuning in. Remember, Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.